withdrawing the senses from the sense objects.
Mm.
I want you to just talk about that. Talk about what actually, very fundamental, it is happening.
There are two beautiful concepts, because at present for us it's mere, these two are mere concepts. It should never be lost sight of. If I feel I'm missing or you are missing, I'll come back to it. There are two concepts. One, withdrawing the senses from their objects. The other, which is very beautifully expressed in the Bhagavad Gita, guna guneshu vartante iti matva nasajjate. The gunas are the qualities of nature, or the natural qualities, play with their own counterparts. There doesn't seem to be a question of withdrawal. On the one hand, we are asked to withdraw the senses from the sense objects. And that is very beautifully put in the same Bhagavad Gita. The Kurmungāniva sarvaśaḥ indriyāni indriyārtheṣu tasya prajñā pratiṣṭhita. Yadā samharate cāyam kurmungāniva sarvaśaḥ. Who is a yogi or a sage? He who is able to withdraw his senses from contact with their objects, just like the tortoise withdraws its limbs into its shell. We don't even have to go to two different texts. Then you may say that that's one man's point of view, this is another man's point of view. Here it is the same master suggesting these two things. One, the withdrawal, and the other, the recognition that the senses play, or the qualities of nature play with their own counterparts.
I don't understand what you mean.
Huh?
What do you mean the qualities of nature play with guna their own gune,
correct. Guna guneshu vartanta. This is the original expression in the Bhagavad Gita. Guna guneshu vartanta iti matva sarnasajjate. Which is very simple. That is, my sight sees a form. What is called a form is nothing but the object of vision. Illumined form. You know, it's not that tactile form. Form in its size and weight and all that. The form, the visible form, is the object of sight. Color is the object of sight. Instead of the form, you can use the word color. Color is the object of sight. Color is never the object of taste. Spices are the objects of taste. Except in one sense, they are not the object of sight. You can take some pepper powder and drop it into my eyes. Well, I'll also see that they are pepper. Except in that sense, taste is not the object of sight, of eyes. Taste is the object of the sense of taste. So one responds to the other. These two go together. Can they be separated? I suppose they can, but what for is the question. Can they be? Can this chain be broken?
Between the sense and the object.
between the sense and the object. Possible. It happens naturally in the case of sleep, swoon and paralysis. And it can happen voluntarily if you cultivate the ability to produce some sort of sensory paralysis. This story is told, and this is quite a famous one amongst the Indian yogis, of a great saint who was the pet of his favorite of his guru. Young man, the saint was a young man, and he was the pet or the favorite of his guru, and therefore there was a little jealousy amongst the other disciples of the guru. Why does the guru only like this chap? And why does the guru allow him freedom which he doesn't allow us? The guru allowed this pet disciple to eat what he liked, whatever came to him. Not what he liked, whatever came to him. Whereas with the others, he was very strict. And so one day it is said, in the presence of all these disciples, the guru called this favorite one and asked him, put out your tongue. He put the tongue out. And the guru had a cup full of sugar. And he picked up a handful of sugar, dropped it on the tongue, hold it there. He held it. Blow it to the last grain. The sugar flew away. Can you do it? I guess not. Because the moment the sugar touches the tongue, there is what you call the natural reaction of the taste buds. Saliva is produced and the sugar gets dissolved. The lesson here is that this young man had such tremendous control over his senses that he was able to cause a withdrawal of the senses from the sense objects. You have also heard, I'm sure, or read somewhere here and there, what tremendous and total concentration means. I don't know if you come to that point yet in the Buddha's daily readings. There also, there is a sort of exchange of experiences. Someone was meditating and an army passed nearby and he didn't even know. Someone else was meditating outside in the open. There was a terrific thunderstorm and cyclone, typhoon and what have you, and he didn't even know. Anything. Possible. And you have heard of what it is to concentrate your total attention upon something so that if you are looking at that spot on the wall, all of us disappear. Only that is visible.
Possible.
None of these things need be challenged. These are exercises at concentration. I must be very careful. One little inattention might lead you completely astray. If while I am talking to you, I am terribly serious and therefore terribly concentrated, it is possible that I am looking at you, listening to you, and I even listen to the slightest movement of your lips, whereas I don't hear the traffic noise for the time being. Does that in any way constitute pratyahara or total withdrawal of the senses? No. Because I am hearing you with the greatest of keenness. But I have switched off the hearing, the sense of hearing, from hearing other things. To a lesser extent, it is possible to see that if I am looking at you with all my heart and soul and what have you, it is possible that I don't listen to somebody calling out to me. Two different things. The sense of sight is so deeply involved in its object that the sense of hearing has very little energy left. Is this pratyahara? Is this withdrawal of the senses? No. For the simple reason that in the first case, the energies involved in the sense of sight are focused and directed towards one object, which means the subject and the object were still there. Are we together still? The subject and the object are still there. The subject and the object of sight are still there. But whereas to begin with, the subject of sight was not attentive and therefore its energies were dissipated. Later, all that dissipation was avoided and the energies were brought to a tremendously intense central beam. But the subject and the object are still there. The second case, there is such intense attention. I am seeing. You are dancing or you are doing something, and I am seeing. The sight takes up so much of concentration of energy that very little is left for the hearing. Just as for instance, for the last 5 minutes at least, you are not aware of your toes touching the carpet. The senses of sight and hearing have appropriated to themselves so much of the energy that there is very little left for the sense of touch to function with. Is there a withdrawal of the senses? The senses still function, one or the other. And merely there is a juggling of the quantum of energy available to one or the other of the senses. These may be very efficient mental training of the mind. They do not fall under either of the two categories we started with. Total withdrawal of senses, kurmonganiva sarvasha, from all directions. The yogi withdraws his senses, in samadhi. You can call it what you like, I'm not interested. It is like the state of sleep. When all the senses are withdrawn into the shell called sleep. Correct? Like. That's a very important word that should not be forgotten. Leave that alone. Like the state of sleep, don't forget that phrase, but leave that alone. We'll come back to this. And this we have discussed quite often. Sight sees, which means the ear does not see. The ear hears. The eyes do not hear. Keeping your eyes open in a light situation like this, can you completely obliterate vision so long as your eyes are in good condition? No. They will still see. Why do I say, I see you? If I cannot prevent the sight from seeing you, it is natural for sight to see, isn't it? It is natural for sight to see. What do we mean by it is natural for sight to see? The eyes of a living, or the living eyes, we can put it that way, are endowed with the energy or the faculty of seeing. Living eyes are endowed with the faculty of seeing, and they see. Living ears are endowed with the faculty of hearing, and they hear. Living tongue is endowed with the faculty of tasting it, and it tastes. In the case of paralysis, the livingness of that particular organ is switched off. It is dead, yes? That's what you call paralysis. In the case of swoon, again, the life force is withdrawn from that organ, and therefore it is dead, as good as dead. So, the living eyes see, the living ears hear, the living tongue tastes, the living skin touches, this is the other concept. What is common to both these to the sleep state where all the senses are withdrawn into the shell called sleep, and into this state where the senses function in their own fields. The ego is absent in both these. In the sleep state, there is nobody to say, I do not see. And in this state, there is nobody to say, I see. There is no entity to say, I see. If this is maintained, you are enlightened. Don't ask me who it is. Who is enlightened? If this is maintained, you are enlightened. At times, you withdraw all the senses into the shell, for instance, when you are meditating seriously, or you are sleeping. Or there may be occasions when you just want to withdraw all your senses. You don't want to hear, you don't want to see, you don't want to touch, you don't want to taste nothing. If you observe yourself at that point, it is even possible that you will discover that in order to do that, initially at least, you have to create an internal counterpart of these external things. In order to effect this tortoise-like withdrawal, You can do that even though open eyes, though it's not very healthy, I suppose. While keeping your eyes open, powerfully think of something within yourself. An image or something like that. It's possible after a few minutes you may not see what is outside. But that is not complete withdrawal of the senses. Why? Because you are creating a form within yourself, an object of sight within yourself. What do you mean within yourself? I don't know. Because even though it is within your shirt, it is still outside of that which sees. Words and words. That's like a dream, daydreaming. Mm-hmm. We are all familiar with that. We have all done it sometime or the other. We are seriously engaged in daydreaming. Even though your eyes are open, they don't see, which means they don't see what is in front of them. It's nothing in front, but you are seeing. The sight is still seeing something, and that is its object. The distinction between an external form, which the sight sees, and an internal daydreaming form which the sight sees, that distinction is verbal, it's nothing, it's not a serious distinction. That is what we are asked or encouraged to do in meditation. If you want to shut your sense of sight out, you visualize a divine form within yourself. And focus all your attention upon that, then it is possible that the mind doesn't create its own procession of forms. And you can do that facing a blank wall, as the Zen people do. It's very good. But still, even there, the sight is seeing something as an object. And it is not what we are really after. What we are really after in both these, the one practice of withdrawal like the tortoise, and the other realizing that these faculties, sense faculties, function in their own spheres. In both these cases, there is a dramatic absence of the ego or the subject. If that is understood and achieved, to put it rather crudely, then you have found your foothold. Tasya prajna pratishthita. His awareness is unshakable. That awareness is unshakable. In meditation, it is possible, in what is called the practice of meditation, it is possible that you sit here and close your eyes, wipe out the entire world, the external world as well as the internal world. And then you open your eyes, you come out, and let the sense faculties function in their own respective fields without creating a subject. Swami Nishreyasananda, only one of you knows him, once explained this very beautifully. There are two what are known as Mahavakyas. Mahavakyas mean great declarations. in the Upanishads. One is Aham Brahmasmi, I am the infinite. The other is Tattvamasi, you are that. And he said to a yogi, when he sits down for his meditation, he realizes Aham Brahmasmi, I am the infinite. And when he comes out of his meditation room and sees people, talks to people, and deals with them, he says, Tattvamasi, you are that, you are the infinite too. I am the infinite, and now you are the infinite. So infinite colliding with infinite is infinite, and there is nothing else. It's a beautiful thought. That's not the usual interpretation. No. This is a very beautiful interpretation.
Swami, with the senses, if we take the mind as being the sixth sense, and the thoughts as the corresponding sense object, would the mind have the same relationship to the sense of thought?
Yes, sir, sure. Sure, senses mean anything. It doesn't matter. Six have been mentioned. 5 plus 1, 6 have been mentioned in the text. You can create a few more. What's wrong with that? Clairvoyance, clairaudience, all sorts of things. You can add a few more. That with which you experience something called an object, whether it is, again, experienced as an external object or an internal object, that is the sense. We may have 5 plus 1, there may be many more. In both these cases, it is egolessness that is indicated. To sustain the ego and play with all these games is useless. In other words, you cannot say, I have withdrawn all my senses. Doesn't work that way. Or, I see that my senses play with these senses, with their respective objects. That doesn't work. This is all bluffing. And therefore, they say that this is an inexpressible state, because eto vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha. That is, you can neither experience it as this is what I am experiencing, nor express this is what I have realized. Just as sleep. You cannot say that, I am having a blissful sleep. And you cannot come back and describe it. And yet, it was obviously an experience which is indescribable. It is described as peace and so on, only because during that period you are not, you didn't experience anything else. But you did not experience peace, you did not experience bliss. You are ignorant of everything. So here too, you cannot say that I am experiencing the supreme bliss. Some people have said so, I don't know, we don't know what they meant by what they said. Yeah, Buddha might say so, or Krishna might say so, or Jesus Christ might say so. It's very difficult for our minds to understand that. Since it is a state of total subjectlessness and therefore objectlessness. Total I-lessness, egolessness. When the ego is completely absent, who is it that experiences? Gunas are technically meant to suggest something else. But let us... in relation to what we are discussing, it is quite simple. The faculty of sight is to be able to see. That is its guna. Yeah, that's all that we need to understand.
Is its qualities?
Yeah. Yeah. The quality of sight is to see, is to be able to see faculty, the faculty of sight. And what does the faculty of sight see? Colors. They are the characteristics of the seen object.
Concept of life.
Sure. Life has some its own characteristics. Now I am taking this word guna as a simple Sanskrit word, which means quality. Philosophically, it has other complicated descriptions and so on, definitions and descriptions, and it's unnecessary.
Somebody in my class has been reading the university, and she was very puzzled about getting rid of the ego, because all the psychology books say that she was building up the ego.
Yes, yeah, sure, build. If you want to build up your ego, build it to invariant proportions, infinite proportions. Why stop at anything else? One sees this very clearly. If I build up what is called my ego, which means the personality which calls itself Swami Venkateshananda, an Indian, a Swami, and you build up your ego, which is Susan Day, an actress, and then this and that, and a genius, and a theosophist, and an enlightened person, a future Buddha. These two are bound to come into conflict. Sooner or later.
Very soon.
Sooner or later. Sooner or later. Because go on expanding, this is going on expanding, and that's going on expanding too, and they must encroach upon each other's territory. Right. So, two infinites cannot coexist.
Well, on the way they can't. I mean, as we're growing towards the infinite, there's no room for the other.
There's no room for the other. So, at that point, as we encroach upon each other's territory, we have to make up our mind. Either I swallow you, or I allow myself to be swallowed. If I swallow you, I become the total infinite. I have swallowed everybody, everything. I am everything. Or I allow myself to be swallowed. I am nothing. Both ways you get to the same point. Same point. It is only this psychological interpretation of individuation as developing your personality, that's where you come into all sorts of funny situations. No. Egolessness means this. that if you dissect yourself, examine yourself, there is nothing which corresponds to I am, ego. Nose, ears, eyes. And all these things have been...
Is it developing enough, is a psychologist trying to say to develop enough will to be able to let go of the ego? You know, to be strong enough to...
That's a very beautiful idea, but I doubt very much that they have such sense.
It takes strength to let go of
it. That's what I'm saying. It's a very beautiful idea, but I very much doubt that they have so much sense. What they are concerned about is that he must have sufficient strength to compete with the rest of the world and
still
win.
Remain respectable.
Win and still being respectable.
And of course, developing the ego, you have to become obnoxious, more obnoxious to find the infinite.
Yeah.
Very courageous path.
There was an Italian who set up some sort of a business near Cologne, and he started that. I am the center of the world, and one must develop one's ego, not surrender. He came one day to argue with me. I collapsed. I said, I have no idea at all of your philosophy, sir. You're marvelous, fantastic.
He became swallowed.
I was swallowed. I mean, instantly swallowed. But since there was nothing to swallow, he couldn't digest me. You can't swallow anything and then be satisfied. And he lasted only for a short while, 6 months or so, and then he... The problem is this. He is a teacher of ego. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way. He is a teacher of ego. So he has himself to keep his ego strong and strong and strong and strong and stronger than all the egos that he is promoting. If I continue to tell her, my dear, you must strengthen yourself, she's bound to try that strength even on me one of these days. Inevitable. There is a funny story of a demon in the Bhagavatam, is it? Yes. Who engaged himself in unprecedented austerity and penance and meditation. Lord Shiva appeared in front of him and said, my son, I am highly pleased with your devotion and penance. What do you want? He said, Lord, I want only one thing. A simple boon from you. Whomever I touch must be reduced to ashes. Hey, that all you want? Granted. Hey, wait a moment. Let me touch you. How do I know that you are serious? That in granting me this boon. Come on, sit down, let me touch your head. And Shiva got frightened and ran away. Then there are several versions of the comedy, tragicomedy. And it is said that Vishnu intervened. He took the form of a young boy and was planting a tree upside down, a little plant, sapling. He dug a hole, put the branches in, the roots up, and closing it and started trying to water. This demon was running after Shiva and on the way saw this stupid thing. He stopped there and said, what a stupid thing you are, what are you doing here? And this young fellow looked up and said, I'm not as stupid as you are. Don't be cross. You believe that madman and thought that he gave you the secret of burning other people. He didn't, and that's why he ran away. You seem to know more about all this than I do. No, this happened with thousands of miles away, and you seem to know what happened. But he gave me the boon. So, Don, you are as much a learned man as I am. In, you know, the art of using a mantra, there are certain preliminaries and there are certain rules and regulations that must be very strictly followed. And if you don't follow them, the mantras don't work. And I will teach you if you want. I will give you the preliminaries. And then the boon that he granted you will work. This boy seems to be quite sensible. The demon sat down and said, come on, teach me. First you must take water and sip it three times. Achyutaya namaha, Anantaya namaha, Govindaya namaha. He did it that. Then you must do pranayama. He did it. And then you must repeat the name of God in a certain way. And this is how one does. Pranavasa, Rishi, Brahma, Devi, Gayatri, Chandra, Paramatma, Devata. This is how you must touch your various parts of your body and then you vitalize yourself. Then the mantra will work. And he said, all right, teach me. Pranavasa, Rishi, Brahma. Pranavasa, Rishi, Brahma, he touched his own head and he got burnt. So, if you develop the ego of, if you preach that doctrine, that your ego must be developed, you come into conflict with your own children and disciples. Immediately, it has to be. If it does not happen, your teaching is useless. If that does not happen, your teaching is useless. If you teach me to be independent, I'm going to declare independence from you first, before doing anything else. There's another funny story. David borrowed $5,000 from Peter. And the due date came for the money to be repaid. He went to a lawyer and said, look, I did borrow so much money from him, but I don't want to repay. Can you help me? And the lawyer said, of course, I can always help you. To help the clients is my job. Okay, 5,000. If I get you off the hook, are you prepared to share these spoils with me? 50-50. You keep 50, I give me 50. Okay, agreed. And he said, this is the secret. He is going to court and sue you for the money, and you will be hauled up before the magistrate. Please do one thing. Whatever question the magistrate or anybody asks you in the courtroom, say where? Just that. And in defense, I'll argue that you are insane and therefore nothing can be done. And according to law, the magistrate must dismiss the case. You are free. It's good here. Very good. And that's precisely what happened. He said, bah, bah, or whatever the magistrate asked, or the prosecutor asked, or the other counsel asked. And the magistrate said, dismissed. Case dismissed. They all came out, and the lawyer congratulated David, and David congratulated the lawyer. And then a little later he said, what about my half? Bad. It was bad to him, but to you.
He was doing what he was told. Do
what you were told. So in advocating this theory that you must all develop your ego, we'll come to grief sometime or the other, sooner or later. But all this is what the psychologist might call pragmatic philosophy. That in this world you cannot live without a strong ego, that is their contention. What they don't see is that in this world it is impossible to live with an ego. Now, the mystics, on the other hand, they ignore all these wrangling. That's of no importance whatsoever. First of all, they say, find out if there is one. If it is there, then develop it. But it's quite possible that it is not there, and what are you doing? Both attitudes may be defective. To develop the ego may be as defective as to get rid of the ego. This is the answer. But it's not easy to explain it to one who is not prepared to listen.
Hari Om Tat Sat.